Session number 28933, Cyril Pierce, part 7.
Cyril, you were telling me about hung up bombs.
There had been on the six squadrons four occasions when bombs had exploded when the armourers were taking them out. They were hang ups and the armourers were taking them out of the aircraft. They knew from their records that they all had time fuses in them. And of course they would have known how long the fuse would last before it blew up. And a lot of armourers were killed, as you can imagine. If you're on top of a bomb when it goes up, you go with it. And so the order came out that no bomb, no hang-ups were to be brought back. You had to get rid of them. So when Eric told me there were two hung up, I opened the bomb doors and then I started to throw the Wimpy about in all directions, diving, stalling, half turning, doing everything I could, and I got rid of one of them. But the other one was jammed. So Eric said, right, we've got to get rid of it. So he got the axe, and there's always an axe on an aircraft, and he chopped through the top of the bomb bay, which was wood. He chopped a fair-sized hole in it so that he could get down. I got Eric, my navigator, and Jack, my wireless op. Eric took off his flying boots and his stockings, and they lowered him down into the bomb bay, holding tightly onto his feet, and with the axe he eventually got rid of this bomb. He made a hell of a mess of the racks, the bomb racks in the bomb bay, but we got rid of it, so closed the doors and came home. And of course at debriefing we told the debriefing officer what had happened. And I said to him, the armourers are not going to be very pleased because there's a hell of a mess. But I said, we have done what you have told us to do. And he said, that's fine. Now, Eric, my bomb aimer, and Jessie, his wife, we remained very good friends after the war. We had them up here to stay with us. And Doreen put on a meal, and at the same time we invited a very good Spitfire pilot, a friend of mine, whose name was Ronald Johnson, who lived just down the road, he and his wife, to a meal. We had the meal, and then of course Johnny was a fighter pilot. He'd never been in a bomber, and Eric was talking about various things, and he was giving names of the parts of the bomb site which Johnny didn't understand and was going on about it. And he then said, of course, do you remember when we had the hang-up, Cyril? I said, yes, I remember, all right. So then he, of course, explained to everybody exactly what had happened. We were coming back home at about 7,000 feet in the middle of the night, in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, and there weren't any aircrew rescue in the Med. That would have been any good anyway. And Jessie, Eric's wife, was listening to this, and as he went on, how he was hung, being held by his ankles, head down in the bomb bay, chopping away at this thing. And when he actually finished and said, right, we've got rid of the bomb, she hit him on the arm like that and said, Eric, you can't swim. Now, as you can imagine, the uproar that created, 7,000 feet in the middle of the night, without a parachute, what does it matter whether you could swim or not? So that's a good story. I've had many a drink on that story, I can tell you. Of course, poor old Eric is now dead. I went up to his funeral about 6 years ago up in Chester. In fact, I'm the only survivor now of my bomb crew, because my WOP, AG, died last December in Bude in Cornwall. So I'm the only one left. But I thought that was a good story. Now, then, of course, I carried on with my first tour. I keep on saying, the visibility, it was so good in Italy that it was very difficult indeed not to find your targets. Now, there is one other incident I'd like to mention. The aircraft that I hit while I was taxiing was, of course, they cannibalised it and gave it a new wing, a new tail and rudder. And I was at the, when I went to the flight op for the battle order, I found that I had been given this Wimpy on my next operation. And it was to go up to Leghorn in Italy to drop leaflets, nickels as they were called, which was a complete and utter waste of time. Anyway, that I did. And then I... That's on the way back, of course, there was a problem with the engine. It kept backfiring, the port engine kept backfiring. So I had to divert. Sicily was now in our hands, so I thought there's only one thing to do is to go to the airfield in Sicily. I kept the engine going, it was backfiring like hell, but we eventually got to the airfield in Sicily, and I landed, as soon as I landed, not only did the Duff engine suddenly stop without me touching the throttles, but the starboard engine stopped. And so this is where I made this landing that Jack was referring to. It was on one engine, and they found... they repaired the aircraft and they found that there was water. It had been in the petrol tank. It had been in the sun so long that water, I presume with the tank empty, that it had condensation had occurred in the engine. And of course, as you know, petrol floats on top. It was only when I was getting near the bottom of the tank that it started hitting water, and this is what was causing the backfiring. Anyway, this was a bowfighter squadron in Sicily where I landed, where they had Hercules engines, so they knew all about it, and they told me what had happened, and I flew back to base, and they gave me a written report, and I presume the fitters had been given a good tearing off, allowing this condensation to happen. But on a following operation, I had the same aircraft again. And I took off, and as soon as I was airborne, I pulled the wheels up. The port engine caught fire. There's sparks shooting out of it, and I was only at about 100 feet. Fortunately, I was facing into the desert because one of the runways at Kairouan took you straight over the town of Kairouan. So I had to do some emergency work. I left the flaps down. You put 15 degrees of flap down before you took off. I pulled the throttles back, told Eric, the bomber, to press the Gravener switch, which is on the right-hand side of the aircraft, which operates the fire extinguishing system. And I said, oh, for Christ's sake, press the left one, not the right one, which he did. The fire went out, and I then, of course, I had 750 gallons of petrol on board. I had 4,500 pounds of bombs on board, and I had an aircraft which, of course, couldn't fly with all that load on. So as we were heading directly into the desert, I simply opened the bomb doors and I got a switch, a lever at the front, which I could jettison the bombs, which I did. Jettisoned the bombs, got rid of those. I didn't try and unload. There was a device in the aircraft for getting rid of petrol. We could turn this round and petrol would come out. But of course I didn't touch that, because if I had done, this hot engine would immediately have burst into flame. So I had to then do a complete circuit at a low height and made a good landing on one engine. And of course the flight commander in his galley, they'd seen all this from the ground, all the bloody sparks coming out, and I'd given the mayday call anyway that I'd got to land because the engine was on fire. And he of course came up when I'd actually landed and just managed to get off the runway. And I said to him, his name was Squadron Leader Audouin, and I said, "Sir, this bloody aircraft is a Jonah for me." I said, three times I've had trouble with it, and I said, "I don't want to fly it again." He said, "All right, Pierce," he said, "I'll make sure you don't." After that, I only had... I think I said it didn't count as an operation since I didn't go anywhere. I only had two more operations to do, and by that time I had got 249 hours 45 minutes operational time, which was 15 minutes short of the 250. So that was the end of my tour, and I'd done 38 operations.
Now, Cyril, you don't appear to have had your own aircraft at any stage. How did that work?
No, it was simply at when you went to see the battle order that you found that the aircraft had been allocated to you by either the flight commander or the deputy flight commander. You weren't... You didn't stick to one aircraft, they simply put your name down, then they looked through the list of aircraft available and gave you an offer. It didn't really matter. And so although I did quite a few on 467, there you see, I did quite a few on that. As I was getting more experience, I think as you were getting more experience, they kept you to the same aircraft to some degree. But when you started off as Frog aircrew, of course, you had anything that was going. I did, yes, I'd done quite a few on this.
Now, Cyril, what rank, you were a sergeant pilot when you started?
Yes, I was a sergeant.
And what rank were you when
you
finished? After
you 1 year's service, you should have been promoted to flight sergeant. And after 2 years service, to warrant officer. For the commissions ranks, after 1 year's service as a pilot officer, you would be promoted to flying officer, and after 2 years in service as aircrew on ops, you became a flight lieutenant. Now, I was given my wings on September the 6th, 1942, in America. By September the 6th, I was half in 1943. I was more or less half, three quarters of the way through my tour, and I had applied for a commission. And I was interviewed for a commission, and the things were sent up. I never did get the rank of flight sergeant, because when I got to Palestine as an instructor, I was called, that would have been in April 44, I was called to the station commander's office and told that my commission had come through, that I was therefore now a pilot officer. But no back pay was awarded. So I never got the rank of flight sergeant, which was, of course, an increase in pay. And they backdated my commission from the day of my interview, which was in September 43, but they gave no back pay. You started to earn your pilot officer's pay as soon as you were told. And yet on my big parchment, they've got there quite clearly that I was commissioned at this day in September. So they were very crafty with the money, the RAF. I got a £65 allowance in cash, because I had to hand in all my RAF gear and buy, of course, the officer's equipment. But that's will come up later in the story. So when I finished my tour, up till then, all the tour expired people in the Middle East had been sent back to England to act as screens, which is the term for instructors at operational training units. They don't call them instructors, they call them screens. But when I finished my tour, hoping to get back, they changed the rules. They had decided to, well, they had already started to build an operational training unit in Palestine. Don't forget, as part of the Empire training scheme, there were a lot of aircrew who were trained in Rhodesia and South Africa. Now, there was already one operational training unit in the Middle East, but it wasn't enough, so they decided to open another one. Instead of these people going back to England to crew up and to join OTUs, and then some of them were sent back to the Middle East, which was a waste of time, they opened this new operation training unit. Now, I was on, as I'd finished my tour, and they said, right, you're not going back to England, which was the biggest disappointment in my life, and you're going to Palestine. Well, we had no option. Eric Taylor, my navigator, got jaundice. So he was sent back to England. And the rest of us, me and the other three of my crew, were sent down, first of all, to Cairo on leave. We were all sergeants, so we lived in, there was a special hospice there for, which was for aircrew on leave. But, of course, we were there for some time before I ran out of money. I finished my tour on 142 Squadron on the 10th of October 44, and I was then sent down to Egypt, and on leaving Cairo. But we ran out of money, and so we had to ask to be posted to our operational training unit. And I was posted to there on the 3rd of December 1943, and they were still building it. What they'd done is they'd commandeered land from the Arabs, who were living rightfully in Palestine, and had built this airfield, all concrete. They'd got two runways, all properly concreted, with concrete barrack blocks and toilet blocks. Again, they had seats, though. Although they were cesspits, they were great big holes in the ground, and as far as I know, they never were emptied. It was while I was there, of course, I was commissioned later. So then we started to train the air crew, which were coming up from Rhodesia and South Africa. They had to crew them up and show them how to fly and operate a Wellington. Fortunately, I was posted to Fighter Affiliation Flight, which was the easiest one, because I flew the aircraft most of the time, while air gunners were having practice attacks from Defiance, using a camera gun, or when the Defiance were towing targets on very long ropes, and some of them weren't happy about the length of the ropes, they used actual ammunition for firing, and the ammunition was coloured so that they would count the holes in the target to see which of the air gunners had scored more hits. I knew, of course, in the RAF you had to do, if you volunteered for aircrew, you had to do two tours. It was compulsory. You couldn't unvolunteer. I was anxious to get back to England, so I kept on pestering when I was going on my second tour. Unfortunately, Eric Scott, my bomb aimer, was posted back to his second tour about 2 weeks before me. But I was posted back for my second tour, and I got back to 142 Squadron on the 1st of... at San Severo, which is near Foggia in Italy, on the 16th of September 1944. And there's Foggia. There. And that's Mount Gargano. I'll tell you about that in a minute. I did three trips with 142 Squadron, and then it was disbanded. And I met, of course, a lot of the ground staff who'd been on 142 Squadron in the desert, like the intelligence officer and the cook and other people. But after three trips with them, 142 was disbanded with its sister squadron, 150, and I was then posted to number 70 Squadron, because I'd only done three trips.
So were you with any of your original crew members?
Yeah. Now the point was, when I was posted back, I was posted back at the same time as Ted, my rear gunner, and Jack Morville, my WAPAG. As I said, Eric Taylor had been sent back to England, and Eric Scott had been posted back to his second tour 2 weeks before me, and he crewed up with other people because they were all experienced pilots, all experienced aircrew, you see, because they had to be, because they were on their second tour. And so I had two, but I'd made a very good friend in Castina of Bill Robinson, who was a navigator, so I coddled him straight away as my navigator. And Bob Lewis, who was the City of London copper, was a bomb aimer, and I got him as my bomb aimer. So we did the three ops with 142, then I was posted to the 70 Squadron. We flew the aircraft over. We had a fairly big sized bell tent which we took with us, because again it was all in the open. They'd simply commandeered land from the Italians and built a runway, but this time it was PSP, pierced steel plating runway, which of course all they had to do was to flatten the ground out and lay this PSP strip by strip by strip. And as long as you've got enough, you can have a runway as long and as wide as you want. And it makes a wonderful landing surface, except as you touch down, these things make a hell of a clanking noise as they all click together. So I was with 170. Our operations were over northern Italy, because the 8th Army were fighting their way all the way, and as you know, they had a terrible time, of both the 8th Army and the 5th Army and the Americans, fighting their way up to Italy, because they were being opposed by the Germans all the time. So we were bombing targets along the Italian Adriatic Sea, and then targets in northern Italy, targets over in Hungary. We didn't, as the Wimpy, of course, didn't have the range. Again, I was very lucky, because by the time I got to my second tour, the oil wells at Ploesti had been captured by the Russians. Up till then, the oil wells at Ploesti was the second most heavily defended target in the world after Berlin. So that had been finished with, and I didn't have to go on those because they were, that was where the casualties were as bad, if not worse, than in Berlin, than in Germany. Also, they had been mining the Danube. Now, the Danube, the Germans were using the Danube as their main artery because the Russians were attacking from the east, and they were using the Danube as their main artery to bring supplies down to their armies, arms, tanks, everything you could think of. And to mine the Danube, you had to have two naval mines, and naval personnel came to the squadron and fitted the mines on, and a Wimpy could carry two, whereas a Liberator could carry four. And to drop these mines, you had to descend to 100 feet above the level of the river and drop them at a speed of 140 miles per hour so that they would enter the river properly and function. If you were higher than that, faster or slower, then they might bust up and be useless. And they were using, of course, the Danube. The Germans didn't know, but they even defended the Danube very well. And there are some accounts I've heard from blokes who are on it where the flak was actually shooting down, because the Danube can be in deep gorges, and the flak guns were actually shooting down on the aircraft. That had been finished, so I missed that, which was again very, very dangerous. This is why I'm saying I was very lucky. We did a lot of trips. I was my flying officer rank came through while I was there, and then the flight commander of B flight and his assistant had finished their tours, so they promoted. They used a squadron leader called Winterbottom, who I'd been with, who had been in charge of the affiliation flight in Castina. They made him flight commander, squadron leader Winterbottom, and we all called him Frosty Bum, not to his face, but he was always known as Frosty. And when I got my flying officer rank, he was made flight commander, and he saw the commanding officer and said, "The most experienced pilot you've got on B flight is Pierce." And therefore, that's how I became deputy flight commander. But a deputy flight commander had to be a flight lieutenant, so I was made acting flight lieutenant, the rank that I held until I came back to England, when, of course, I had to drop it and go back to flying officer.
And what were your duties as?
Well, you had to help run the flight. Now, each squadron had two flights, and you had the deputy flight commander, and the flight commander and deputy had to, of course, run the flight.